Are you feeling overwhelmed by anxiety, struggling to find restful sleep, or plagued by a restless inability to focus? It's time to break free from the chains of mental health challenges and discover a path to healthy living. Welcome to Amen University, founded by renowned psychiatrist and brain health expert, Dr. Daniel Amen. Dr. Amen, alongside a team of esteemed doctors and experts in their fields, understands the struggles you're facing and are here to offer solutions. From debilitating anxiety to sleepless nights filled with worry, our courses are meticulously crafted to target these specific challenges head on. Join us on a journey of transformation led by Dr. Amen and a roster of top-tier professionals. Say goodbye to the constant battle with your mind and embrace a future filled with hope and possibility. Visit our website today to explore our courses and start your journey towards a brighter tomorrow. Use code BRAIN10 and get 10% off. That's code BRAIN10 and get 10% off your first purchase. Amen University, because your mental health matters.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
This is Amy Brown from Four Things with Amy Brown. Today, healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations with Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways that healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.
Hello, and welcome to the Psychology Podcast with Dr. Scott Barry Kaufman, where we give you insights into the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity. Each episode will feature a new guest who will stimulate your mind and give you a greater understanding of yourself, others, and the world we live in. Thanks for listening and enjoy the podcast. Today we have Luke Smiley on the podcast. Luke is a personality researcher and senior lecturer at the University of Melbourne. He runs the Personality Processes Lab. Luke?
Hey, Scott.
Great to have you on here.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah. So you teach a course in happiness, is that right?
I teach across several courses, largely in personality and social psychology. But in some of those subjects, I teach some lectures into well-being and happiness. And I've run a few seminars on that.
Yeah, and it's great that they have Professor Smiley in the course.
It's a nice little coincidence there.
Big attraction to the course. I find your research really quite fascinating and debunking a lot of the myths about personality variation, particularly in the introversion-extroversion dimension. I'm very interested in the core aspects differentiating introverts from extroverts, because people talk about all these kinds of differences, and I'm not convinced they're, you know, these things in the popular media really are the core essential aspects. I thought today we could really get to the nitty-gritty of this.
Yeah, sounds good. I mean, that's that's something that interests me as well, the disconnect between the popular conception of what extroversion, introversion is, which is it's really probably the personality trait that's become a household name, and yet the way in which it's defined in the popular sphere is it differs from one person to another, but it also differs sharply with the definition that's being used in psychological science. So I think there's a lot of confusion around
who's right. I mean, how do we objectively know who's right? I mean, you guys could be wrong.
that's absolutely correct. I mean, I don't think anyone really owns can sort of claim that they own the term and that their definition is correct.
Yeah. Have you read Susan Cain's book, Quiet?
Yeah, I've read Susan Cain's Quiet. Yep. Yep.
What are your thoughts on that, on some of her conceptualizations of introversion?
I think the book's really, its value, I suppose, is that there are a lot of people who identify as an introvert in the way that she defines introversion and feel maybe marginalized or just not sort of part of, not as well accepted by particularly Western society, where extroversion and traits surrounding confidence and talkativeness and outgoingness are really valued. So I think the book really speaks for a lot of people who are maybe tired of what might be perceived to be the most desirable characteristics to have, and she's basically saying, oh well, there are these other characteristics that people have that can be really valuable too. So that's what I think I really like about the book.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean,
it's empowering to a lot of people.
Yeah, definitely. the disagreement that I guess a lot of people in personality would have is again around that definition of introversion, that's not to say that one, who's right and who's wrong there. It's more, you could think of it more as a translation. So when I read Susan Cain's work, I'm really interpreting it as a combination of low introversion as well as some other traits such as openness.
Low introversion? Do you mean low extroversion?
Sorry, low, yes. Introversion, low extroversion. So when she's talking about introversion, I'm indeed interpreting it as introversion, but with some other traits surrounding openness and also conscientiousness.
And neuroticism.
Yeah, neuroticism too. Yeah.
So basically all of personality.
yeah. And there are some, I occasionally also see elements of agreeableness there with being, she often talks about introverts as being more sort of sensitive to others and more thoughtful and aware of how they're impacting on others. And that's sounding a little bit like agreeableness as well. Yeah. So I guess the main disagreement would be that I think there are clearly many people who fit her definition of introversion, but I don't think that that trait she's talking about is a sort of exists as a basic dimension of personality. That's where the divergence is, I guess, between the popular use of the term and the terms that's used in psychological science.
Well, let me say something here. It's possible that even if all the traits and characteristics she puts under the umbrella of introversion don't cohere scientifically as a single source of variation, that doesn't necessarily follow that they don't all belong under the label of introversion. That becomes a conceptual issue.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would say my preference would actually be that psychologists didn't use the term introversion. Yeah, it's just sort of stuck. I think it would take a while to it's such an ingrained term because, the dimension's been around for, 60, 70 years in personality psychology. But I think it's not, it means inward focusing, doesn't it? But it's introversion as defined by psychologists is more about just being less active, less bold, less talkative, less social, more quiet, and so forth. It's nothing necessarily about inwardness. So I actually quite like the term. I can't remember where he suggested it, but our mutual colleague Colin DeYoung has suggested a term, detachment, would be better. And you can see why people who identify as introverts really take issue with the way we describe introverts, because they're probably saying, oh, this sounds like people are really kind of detached and lethargic. We're not like that.
That sounds insulting. That sounds insulting.
And we say, but we're not talking about you guys.
Yes, right. Yeah. It does get very tricky. I've had the great pleasure of collaborating with Susan Keane and her research and her her team there.
Doing this is the thing she just looks. What's it called? The quiet
revolution. Yeah, she just launched the quiet revolution. We came up with a new test of introversion, which Colin's like okay with it. And Adam Grant at Penn really likes the model. But let me tell you the two aspects that we came up with.
Let me see if I can guess.
Oh my gosh, I'd love to see it if you can guess. And just so you know,
I saw the website and I scrolled through the items, and there are definitely two facets there. And one of them I would say is classic introversion, low sociability maybe. And the other is more something more what I would say is related to conscientiousness, persistence, or something like that.
Okay, so that's you almost nailed it.
Yeah.
The second aspect is deliberation.
Deliberation.
Yeah. Okay. Versus action. Need for deliberation versus tendency towards action immediately without thinking through the consequence. So there's this kind of risk taking self-control aspect to it.
Yeah, and that sort of resonates with how Susan talks about introversion in the book, that introverts are these sort of quiet but determined people, people who basically think things through before doing it. You don't just blurt things out and fly off the handle. They're kind of considered, quiet and considered people.
That's right. And that aspect is not very well captured on the Big Five, just at the higher order level.
Yeah. I'm trying to think now about how the sort of lower level traits at the aspect or facet level of the Big Five would correlate.
So at the aspect level of the BFAS model, like conscientiousness, you have orderliness and ambition or something like that. Like
industriousness.
Industriousness, right? It still doesn't quite fit even in those two.
Yeah, okay. It's even lower order than that. But yeah, I mean, I was just – because one of the things, of course, is that components of the Big Five are not as independent as people often assume or describe them to be.
Exactly.
So, I mean, you do have these sort of margins where – some aspects or facets of one Big Five trait are highly correlated with another. Yeah. So,
right. You constantly see that low extroversion is correlated with very strongly positively related to the withdrawal aspect of neuroticism.
Yeah. And we're
talking like we found, 0.60 correlations there in large samples.
Yeah.
So you can't ignore that. You can't deny that.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. And so in that first, let's talk about the first aspect of our model, which you described as like sociability. And that aspect correlates much, much more highly with Big Five extroversion than the deliberation one. However, I don't think, we call it stimulation. We think it goes above just sociability to this general sort of reward sensitivity. And that really gets to the heart of a lot of the research you've been doing on extroversion. So that might be a good segue into maybe you can explain a little bit how you've tried to tackle the question of what is extroversion? What is the core psychological mechanism underlying extroversion?
Yeah. The reward sensitivity theory is one that I've definitely become persuaded by. The reward sensitivity theory of extroversion. And I kind of got to that point, in a way that you might describe as a kind of bottom-up approach, that I was very interested in theories that had suggested that variation in the functioning of the brain's reward system would likely have consequences for personality. That is, if they were kind of individual differences in how motivated people were by rewards, then that should come out somewhere as a major trait, or that should be related to a major aspect of our personality. And in the 90s and the early 2000s, there was a lot of there still wasn't much consensus about what that trait might look like. Some people were saying impulsivity, and some people had said extroversion. And I was at that in the early 2000s. The question that motivated me, or that interested me, if you like, is what is the trait that's really reflecting these differences in reward sensitivity? And I think 10 years on, my impression is that there's really now a lot of consensus around reward sensitivity being one of the key underlying mechanisms that account for differences in extroversion.
Yes, you said there is a consensus, right?
I think so. I don't see any evidence of any sort of debate or discussion around it. It's kind of become definitional now when people describe what extroversion is. If they get anywhere into the theory about it, they're usually saying reward sensitivity or approach motivation and sort of related mechanisms usually get a mention.
So I agree. Let's be very clear. We're talking about appetitive rewards.
Yeah.
We're talking about like money, sex, power.
Yeah, yeah.
All these things that narcissists like.
Yes, that's true.
So I find it interesting. There's a very high correlation between grandiose narcissism and extroversion, probably similar mechanisms at play there.
Which is not surprising. And that, not to go too much on a tangent, but that I think one of the other, because we're talking about conceptualizing extroversion and introversion before, and one of the conceptual confusions or clarifications I think that's often needed is people interpret extroversion as basically being kind of nice and friendly. There's that blurring between extroversion and agreeableness. But I think in an important sense, a lot of what's underlying extroversion is
social attention.
Yeah, is just attention and even selfishness. A strong focus on gains for oneself.
It's such a good point. Such a good point. And then of course you get these blends where you can get high agreeableness and high extroversion, and then it has a different flavor than very low extroversion and very high agreeableness. These people look different. They act differently. They act differently.
Yeah, yeah.
They look different. Some have a bigger forehead.
It's this extroversion agreeableness distinction sometimes really vexes some of my students and. I often get the question, can you even have a person who's really extroverted but really low on agreeableness? My favorite joke is, yeah, of course you can. They're over in the business school.
They're very agentic.
Very agentic.
It's very interesting how all these blends can basically we're just saying that people are complex. We're saying that.
And that's also, I think, maybe it's an obvious point, but it's also why people have, even when they know a lot about models of personality, they might have a little bit of difficulty describing themselves because they're trying to think of these traits in isolation, whereas when you – for each individual, they're complex blends of these traits in most instances.
Absolutely. I want to be clear, this new test of introversion that we came up with, it was built completely from a self-identification of introversion perspective. We wanted to see which items would correlate most strongly with the item I identify as an introvert.
All right. That's a really interesting approach.
Yeah. So it's a different kind of approach than the Big Five took. We specifically for the purposes of creating a scale that introverts could really identify with.
Yeah.
And we found that those were the two. So it's the scientific finding there that might be useful to the field is we found these two aspects really get at the core of what everyday people think of when they think of introversion.
Yeah. Okay, that's interesting because if I were to have made a prediction, I would have expected, so, you know, in Big Five terms, this measure that you have is like a blend of components of extroversion and components of conscientiousness.
Right.
What I would have expected in Big Five terms is a blend of extroversion and openness, because the popular conceptualization of introversion is often this kind of inward person who enjoys their inner mental life, who's very curious and not just sort of quiet and more reserved, but very, you know, loves reading and loves to think about ideas and all of these characteristics you would link with openness.
But keep in mind, keep in mind that the way that the items, if you actually look at the nitty-gritty items, there aren't any items like "I love to read," you know.
Yeah.
So if you think about it for a second, we found that, you know, in the BFS mod, in the aspects, the openness to experience domain has intellect and openness, right? And we found that our scale is negatively correlated with intellect, but positively correlated with openness. Because the kinds of items on the intellect scale are, I'm a quick thinker, I like quickly thinking.
That's
completely at odds with people say, I like to deliberate before I think. So I think that this scale kind of highlights the important distinction between quick thinking and deep thinking, or reflective thinking.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Does that make sense? So that's why we don't find our scale. If you look at the higher order level of openness to experience, you get nothing. But it's only really when you break it into the two aspects, then you find like it is positively correlated with openness. Things like I see beauty, you know, I'm very sensitive to the environment, and we also find that our, you know, first aspect of stimulation is very highly related to the withdrawal aspect of neuroticism and the highly sensitive person scale that has been created by the Ahrens. So there is this course, there is this sensitivity aspect that is, you're right, it is part of self-identification of introversion, but you really kind of see that when you separate out the intellect kind of items.
Yeah, okay, that makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm so glad you find that interesting. But a lot of this stuff, you know, it really does get definitional and conceptual. There's no objective truth of what the real introversion is. Like, will the real introversion stand up?
Yeah. I mean, which is why that's why I think in some ways, I'm not saying everybody should stop using the label, but it's become a troublesome term because it has so many different, it does have quite a few different conceptualizations. I mean, at least troublesome in the context of the goals of personality research, I suppose.
I hear intelligence researchers make the same argument about intelligence.
Scott, shut up.
You're making it harder for us to measure G. And it's like, you know, well, I'm sorry that we're like disrupting your science, but there are real people out there in the world who these conceptualizations affect their lives.
Yeah, that's a good point.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I mean, I totally see it from the point of view of the scientist because I am a scientist too. But yeah, I mean, these labels do mean something to people. So you know, how do you spot an extrovert or know if you are one?
I'm gonna obviously speak to the Big Five definition again, but I mean, there's a whole area of research that I haven't done any research in this area myself, but that I've found really interesting is in personality judgments, which is really about that. How accurately can someone perceive your personality from the outside?
Okay.
Extroversion is always found to be the most easily judged, or accuracy is not really the right way to talk about it. You really talk about consensus. So how close a match is there between how you describe yourself on extroversion and how others describe view on extroversion. And even if that person has never even met you and they just see you in a very, you know, have been introduced to you for maybe 5 minutes, they will get reasonable levels of consensus. They'll very quickly be able to pick up on how extroverted you are. And that's because most of the components of extroversion are behavioral, visible. And so it's quite, I mean, I actually had probably the episode that really convinced me that it sounds like a funny thing to say, but that personality was real. So I feel like unknowingly for a while when I was doing my PhD, personality traits, these were just sort of variables. These were hypothetical variables. I never really thought of them as being sort of real things about real people. And then I was doing a study where I had extreme scores on extroversion, high and low, coming into the lab, and it was for an EEG study. And it takes about sort of a half hour to get everything ready for the EEG study, to put the electrode cap on and to do a range of things. And I found I was blind to, I didn't know how, when they came into the lab, I didn't know what their score was, what group they belonged to, whether they were high or low. But I knew about 2 minutes later, because the extroverts were so talkative and so engaged and so kind of wired almost. You just knew immediately who was in the high extroverted group. So I think it's actually very easy to spot an extrovert.
Yeah. At the extremes. And I think this brings an interesting question: is what is an ambivert? What do you believe in the idea of an ambivert? And would you say most people really are ambiverts?
Yeah, I would. I don't think there's. The whole time we've been saying extrovert and introvert, they're just shorthands. Of course, there are no categories, and you know, by the same token, I wouldn't sort of say there's a sort of a category in the middle of ambiverts, but most people, the majority of people, will not be at the extremes by definition. They're going to be somewhere around the middle. And maybe that's another reason why it's often hard to identify. That's where it may be hard to identify somebody as more or less extroverted, because they might not be more or less extroverted. They might be somewhere in the middle. And that's where the majority of people are going to fall.
Okay, and so there's this, like, you know, trying to figure out some of these defining characteristics. A lot of introverts say, you know, it really is about how you recharge your batteries. Like, do you get energized by people, or do you get not the opposite of energized? What's the opposite of the word energized?
What's the opposite of
de-energized?
Sorry, do you mean extroverts being energized?
Yes.
I just didn't hear that. Energized by people.
By people, by vigorous social interactions.
Yeah, I mean, I think I would say that it's maybe not inherently social. It happens that, this brings us back to, I think the idea of getting energized by social interactions is ultimately consistent with the reward sensitivity idea. So the reward sensitivity idea, I've sort of described as extroverts basically get more bang for the buck. They get a lot more of that positive enjoyment out of rewarding stimulating situations. And I just think one of the most important rewarding situations for human beings are social situations. Human contact is rewarding. Many of the rewards we obtained, we get via humans, or they're somehow embedded in social contact.
Give some examples.
Well, you mentioned power, for example. So power and status is rewarding and desirable, and it's inherently embedded in social context. But also, people are, I don't want to sort of describe people as a means to an end, but you rely on people to get many of the things you want. It's very difficult to get many of the things you want just on your own. Whether it be, to get promoted at work, there's somebody who needs to actually give you that promotion. So I think people are, a lot of a lot of rewards we depend on people to get, and a lot of rewards are embedded in social processes themselves.
That's an excellent point. And so
I'm really interested in that, because I think for a lot of people, extroversion is quintessentially social.
Yeah.
But I'm interested in, and this is something I think is really hard to disentangle, is it so you have some people who their kind of version of the reward sensitivity theory of extroversion is the mechanism underlying extroversion is a mechanism for attracting social attention. So that's saying the core of extroversion, it's really driven by some essentially social mechanism.
Right.
But I wonder if it's broader than that, and it just, as I say, it just happens that so much of what we're motivated by is somehow embedded within or connected to social processes.
Yeah, this is an ongoing debate. You know, there was that study where they tried to measure the social aspect and remove the reward value, the way the items were worded. And you know, Colin and I looked at those items and we're like, wait a minute, these items actually are all just extroversion items. So they're just like standard.
This is the one maybe about 10 years ago.
Because there was this back and forth with other, you know, the other research saying, I think the key is this. You know, it's reward sensitivity. Yeah. No, it's social attention. It is hard to really pinpoint you. And you know, when we say the core, what we're saying, you know, to translate into science language, we're saying what's the common variance.
That's what
we're saying. That's not really intuitive to the everyday person what that means. Common variance, you know.
I mean, I think there are maybe two ways of the two things that we're interested in on the science side, and there's the common variance. So that's really what I guess that's the defining characteristics, I suppose, or what the central, you know, if extroversion is really a cluster of characteristics and traits, what is the core of those characteristics and traits? But I think another thing is almost at a kind of different level. It's kind of what's underlying or producing this. What accounts for these traits clustering together so closely? And that's just going back to the reward sensitivity idea again. I mean, that's one thing that I find really compelling about the idea of extroversion being underpinned by the motivation to pursue all kinds of rewards, because I think many of the key traits and characteristics that are kind of bound up in extroversion can be their coherence, the common denominator they have. It seems plausible that could be approach motivation and the desire to seek rewards.
Right.
So everything from, you know, sociability, because of all the what we just discussed with rewards being embedded in social context, to behavioral activity, to achievement, to social dominance, talkativeness, and positive affect.
Yeah, leadership, assertiveness. That's right. It's also hard to distinguish between statements that are just like part of the human condition versus differentiating real like variation. Because like when you say something like, sometimes I can be really extroverted, but sometimes I like to relax quietly at home. Who is like going to say, oh, that's not me at all. You know, like that's such a, that's just called being like freaking human. How can you word is, do you only really get it when you word things like I prefer on average to, you know, we're just talking about averages. We're not talking about absolutes.
Yeah. So, I hope I'm on the right track here. I think there are sort of two things that relate to what you're saying there. And one is, I think when people are responding to one is how we typically measure personality with a questionnaire, and if you focus on any one item, yeah, you're right. It seems like anyone could agree with this, or it might depend on the day whether I agree with this or not. And And that really sort of, I think that underlies a lot of doubt about how well you can measure personality with these questionnaire items. And I guess what I always encourage people to think about is, that you can take issue with any one item, but over sort of 20 of these, if you've consistently agreed with all kinds of different items about this kind of characteristic, then maybe that is starting to say something meaningful about you.
Yeah,
I was going to say the other point that maybe relates to what you were saying is I really like the approach of Will Fleeson, who
I was just going to say Will Fleeson.
Yeah, who really formalizes. So we've kind of tended to conceptualize personality traits as these regularities in the way you behave and regularities in behavior and experience. And he's kind of formalized it by saying, yeah, you know, where our behavior and experience, so take characteristics relating to extroversion, dominance, and talkativeness, that's actually varying for everyone all over the place, across time, across situations. But if you look back over that time period, you'll see that people have a sort of an average level. And you're saying that's what we're talking about. If your average level is relatively high, then you are by definition relatively extroverted. Even if you spent many times during the week being quite talkative or whether you're being talkative or not, whether you're being, you know, relaxed or really outgoing.
Yeah, I really like that approach. It really is. At the end of the day, your personality is simply your habits of behavior on average. Like that, yeah. That's all your personality is. It's like you can change your personality literally if you like change your habits, you know?
Yeah, yeah. There's a really, I don't know if you've seen this, there's a really amazing paper. It's sort of amazing in a way that it's taken so long for a paper like this to come out, but it's just following up people who want to make certain changes to their personality. And I mean, without going into all the details, it shows what people have suspected for a while, that volitional change in personality is possible. And you know, in the case of extroversion, I mean, that may be, as you say, just sort of cultivating habitual ways of behaving.
So can you make yourself more extroverted?
Yeah, I mean, I think. I think that's a common goal, particularly when for people who have maybe jobs or situations in which it can be more advantageous to be a little more bold and dominant and talkative. So, like being a lecturer, you know, I'm probably slightly low on extroversion, maybe middling to just below average, maybe. But it's helpful. So I mean, I can be a better lecturer if I behave in a more extroverted way, and I think people can cultivate these ways of behaving in particular situations. But I guess people may also have, for whatever reason, they may feel like it would be better if they were higher or lower extroversion. Maybe they feel they could just be more outgoing and energized, and they can cultivate different ways of behaving.
Can you make yourself more introverted?
I guess so. I mean, certainly the sort of studies that I've been interested in, again, it was Will Fleeson who developed this paradigm, and I've now done a couple of studies in this area as well. We're just in a small lab context where there's an interactive exercise that a few people are working on. You can just instruct people to behave in ways that are more characteristic of being either extroverted or introverted. And, I mean, people will behave in those ways, and you see effects of acting in a more extroverted way that are reminiscent of actually being more extroverted.
Okay.
which is quite interesting. I mean, I guess that whole area of research basically suggests that if extroversion is just typically is just the kind of your an average level of certain behaviors and experiences, then if you actually engage or disengage in those behaviors, then on average you by definition will be lower or higher in extroversion.
That's right. That's exactly right. And right, it doesn't mean that if you're an introvert, you know, meaning you score extremely high in introversion on the bell curve, that doesn't mean that you never have extroverted behaviors.
No. Yeah. And that's another, I mean, that's kind of why I like this approach of Will Fleeson's in talking about your average levels, because, you know, a typical response when people learn about personality might be, but, you know, I would say I'm quite introverted, but there are plenty of times where I'm, you know, I'll be at a party and I'll be being really gregarious and love being in the center of attention at that particular point, and we'll be really talking with all my friends, but I'm just not like that all the time.
That's right.
And that definition allows for that. You go, yeah, you know, being an introvert does not mean you have an inability to be more extroverted. It just means you have a tendency to be less extroverted.
Well, you know, I find it interesting that introversion is correlated with deficits in social intelligence tests. So maybe there is something going on there, which the less you exercise it, the less developed those skills are.
Yeah, possibly.
I always find that very interesting, even though, of course, I don't want to stereotype. There's plenty of introverts with great social skills.
Yeah.
But you do find that correlation.
Yeah, it's interesting, and I haven't sort of seen a really clear picture of what's going on there. The literature seems sort of fragmented there, but there was a paper a long time ago that found some evidence for the idea that it may not be social skills per se that introverts lack, but that extroverts are a little bit better at multitasking, and that a lot of what's required in social interaction requires you to keep track of a lot of different pieces of information. You've got to be keeping track of what you're saying, what the other person's saying, when it's your turn to talk, and so forth. And so it may, I mean, there's basically some indication that there are a few, I guess, more cognitive skills that may vary with extroversion that actually may explain some of those more social the apparent differences in social skills.
That is very interesting. You know that
it's very fragmented. I haven't seen much on that topic, to be honest.
There certainly needs to be more research on it. I find it very interesting that there's such a strikingly high correlation between the autism spectrum quotient and introversion.
Yeah.
It's very, very high.
Yeah, and that I don't have a really good hypothesis about that, except just to – I mean, it may be the case that there are multiple ways in which you can be – less talkative and sociable and engaged and so forth. And the autism quotient, that may be picking up more on a you would expect that is picking up more on kind of skill deficits and cognitive capacities, whereas introversion may be a little bit more about sort of preferences and the habitual ways of behaving.
I like that. I like that model a lot. There's multiple paths to these different traits.
Yeah, which is, you know, the thornier side of personality. I mean, you could say, oh, it's as simple as that. If you're not very bold and assertive and talkative and behaviorally active, then you're introverted. But there could be many reasons why somebody is not bold, assertive, and talkative.
Right. Mm-hmm. So is it better to be more extroverted or introverted?
Yeah, that's probably the question that the popular writers on introversion really hate. What I imagine they really dislike what a lot of research has shown about extroversion.
Well, yeah, a lot of researchers have shown that extroversion is correlated with higher well-being, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And yeah, there's a lot of people who you know, self-identify as an introvert and don't really like that idea. And there's a great book chapter by John Zelensky at Carleton University in Canada, which kind of walks through all of the objections to this idea that extroverts are happier, perhaps happier or higher on measures of well-being.
Can you send me that?
Yeah, I will send it to you. It's really, I think it's a nice instructional chapter because it kind of goes through each different objection one by one. But I think the research is pretty clear. It's extroversion is one of the strongest predictors of a range of well-being constructs. But I think the caveat maybe the thing to bear in mind is I think there are a couple of things to bear in mind which may make you come short of saying that it's therefore better to be higher in extroversion. One thing is that the aspects of well-being that extroversion predict most clearly are really those intense positive emotions. What's often called activated positive affect, those feelings of liveliness and excitement and enthusiasm, that aroused positive affect. And if you kind of narrow the focus to that, then it's not immediately clear that that is the be all and end all. In fact, there's some evidence that people lower on extroversion or more introverted people actually prefer lower levels of those intense positive states anyway.
Right.
Yeah.
And Susan would make that point.
Yeah. I mean, that I think is probably, the main reason that you would maybe want to come a little bit short of saying, oh, it's therefore better to be more extroverted. Because extroversion is not only correlated with the levels of those positive emotions, but also the preferences for those levels.
Exactly.
And they actually be. I mean, one idea I find interesting is that. So we've talked about how you can act more or less extroverted, and one idea I find interesting is that the way people habitually act is it can partly function as a mood regulation strategy. So extroverts may behave in a way that routinely brings them to these higher levels of positive emotion that they prefer, while introverts may routinely behave in a way that keeps them at those slightly lower levels of these particular positive emotions.
Yeah. There's two projects I want to work on with some students over the course of next year. One is maybe cataloging some of the more quiet positive emotions like contentment. Right.
And that is not. Well, this is this paper that Colin DeYoung and I worked on last year. Those emotions are not really, those positive emotions are not really predicted by extroversion at all.
That's a really important finding, I think.
Yeah. I mean, my sort of take on that issue, it's one of those, it really was one of those situations where it was hard to know whether I was confused or whether there was a confusion in the literature. And so either the paper clarifies something for the literature or it just clarified my own confusion. but the confusion is, yeah, that people use the word positive emotions to refer to actually quite a wide range of constructs. And those quieter positive emotions that you mentioned. The only way in which that seems to be related to higher extroversion is as a result of extroverts tending to be a little bit lower on some aspects of neuroticism. So basically, once you control for neuroticism, there's really no relation between extroversion and those kind of quiet, content, satisfied, relaxed mood states.
Do you mean like you're basically controlling for emotional stability?
Yeah.
Not the other end. Like.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Because you would think those emotions would be correlated with emotional stability.
Yeah.
Well, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
I don't like this question of which is better, which personality trait is better, because we're talking about, you know, that's ignoring blends. That's ignoring the all. If there is no all else being equal, you know, all else being equal in the real world, doesn't really make sense.
Yeah, I don't know. I can't explain why I have the same reaction. I don't like talking about better or worse ends of different personality traits. And that's for that reason, one of the kind of finding that I really enjoy when I see it come out in a paper is where a trait that you normally think of as, or that many people think of as being like the bad end, turns out to have some advantage, or a so-called good trait turns out to predict something undesirable. And I just like those reminders that there's really there are strengths and weaknesses of high or low ends of any characteristic. I don't think overall any, with the exception that I think it's, you know, there are very few advantages to being high in neuroticism or low in emotional stability. With that exception, maybe I think that all traits have really positive, both ends of all traits can have really positive.
I don't know. Attached. Tell some of the greatest poets of all time that their high neuroticism was a disadvantage to their poetry.
Yeah. I think this is just totally anecdotal, but you know, when thinking about historical characters and characters in film and literature, I think you often see the you would characterize them as high in neuroticism. But I think you would also characterize them as being high in openness as well. And those two often, in combination, get blended together.
I think that's absolutely true. And specifically the openness aspect.
Yeah, absolutely.
I agree. This has been such a fascinating conversation. I want to be respectful of your time, but we haven't even gotten to the neurochemistry yet and all that. So what is the role of nature and nurture in determining introversion? I think we can pretty much say that it's a mix of both. But do you think to some extent introversion, extroversion can be influenced all by how you're treated by your peers when you're younger?
I guess there's some I've seen a few ideas along those lines, for example, that there are often, I think extroverts tend to be slightly taller, and there's a sort of a, maybe it's a sort of a wacky fringe idea, but that differences in the height often impact on how you're treated growing up, maybe by your peers, and that may have a role in the development of a more sort of introverted, I guess a less, more or less dominant personality. There are some ideas that I've seen along those lines. But I guess generally, I feel like a lot of people seem to take the lesson of all the behavioral genetics research is that that a lot of the environmental impact is your unique experiences.
Right.
I haven't really gone further to basically say, well, it's, you know, how how your personality doesn't really depend much on those shared experiences that are happening within the family environment. They're being more driven by these unique experiences that you have outside the family environment. But I don't see a lot of sort of following up on that to kind of start to understand what those unique experiences might be.
Right. We just know that unique experiences matter.
Yeah. So I guess I guess the answer is it seems plausible, but I don't know of a lot of work that's sort of shown that.
That's fair. So the best we could say right now is it's nature and nurture.
Yeah.
Okay. I wish we could see more longitudinal studies of personality development from dispositions to traits. Well, what is the role of genes, the brain and neurochemicals? Do you need a brain?
Yeah. All personality traits seem to be at least moderately heritable.
What does that mean?
It means that a large part of the reason that people differ from another or more similar to one another is the result of differences in genes. Yeah.
And what does that mean?
That means that part of the variation that you see in personality in the population is based in differences in genetics in innate biology.
Well, I think that people don't really have a good idea of what that means, of what even differences in genes. It doesn't mean, you know, what does that really mean in terms of the impact on the trait? I saw a study recently that found the higher the heritability – this is going to blow your mind. You ready? The higher the heritability of an IQ test item, the more culturally influenced that item was.
The higher the heritability of that item, the more culturally influenced it was. That actually kind of could make a weird kind of sense.
Yes.
So I don't know if this is right. This is the first time I've heard this, but the kind of thought experiment I would think about was imagine four different cultures that differ really from one another, but each of them have these very they don't have a lot of variation in the environment within each culture.
That's interesting.
So if you had a situation, there's an old saying that I think is called Hernstein's paradox, which is that if you had a perfectly even-handed environment where everybody was basically under the same environmental conditions, a sort of, you know, radical social engineering experiment or something, then all of the variation in personality would be genetic.
Right.
And the reason being that if there's no environmental variation, then it can't explain why people are different from one another. So all of the differences would just be genetic.
So that
finding, I mean, maybe what it's saying is that cultures, there's a lot more variation in the environment between cultures than within cultures. And therefore the aspects, the components. So is the components of intelligence or the items of an intelligence?
Well, if you look at the items, you find that the group together is either crystallized or fluid intelligence.
Yeah.
You find that crystallized items actually have higher heritability than the fluid. The crystallized are in theory the ones that are more dependent on learning and culture. It's just, you know, so this makes sense to you that that'd be higher heritability.
Yeah. So, but if, I mean, the higher heritability may, another way of expressing that might be that there's not a lot of variation within any population that's impacting upon that particular aspect of intelligence. But there might be variation, a lot more variation when you look at the cultural level from one culture to another.
I think that could make sense.
Maybe it makes sense, but
so we took this little
it's interesting. I mean, it's sort of a seemingly paradoxical finding,
right. Exactly.
Which is why we
went on this little tangent, just, and I could easily not have brought that up. I don't think it's as easy, like when we say, like, well, we know that has a heritable coefficient, to really know what that really means from a mechanistic point of view. But so we do know that we can say that genes influence the development of introversion.
Yeah.
What have any of those genes been identified? Do they operate on the dopamine? I mean, according to your theory, they should be dopamine related genes, right?
Yeah. And a colleague of mine, Jan Backer at the University of Hamburg, we just did a review of, tried to do a really critical review of, where is the, how strong is the evidence for this, the idea that extroversion is underpinned by dopamine function, with dopamine being the neurochemical that is involved in reward processing and motivation by reward. And the interesting thing is that the genetic evidence, and this is fairly true for a lot of areas of personality, but the genetic evidence is just really patchy. So by which I mean, even though behavior geneticists have told us, there's a strong role for genes, identifying which genes are involved has been a very not a very successful venture so far. So that's where it gets sort of murky, in the sense that you're on one hand, there seems to be good evidence that there are these genetic influences, but actually pinning them down has not been so successful.
Well, let me ask you something. Mm. There's got to be a affluence of genes related to dopamine, because you find at the neurological level that you see striatum, you see some of these subcortical dopamine structures, you see differences in them, in structure, and function, but between introverts and extroverts. Is there any universe in which you would see those differences without there being genetic differences at all? What would that mean?
I don't think so. I think
genes influence structure.
Yeah. So genes are obviously coding for proteins that build the body and the brain. So they do have an influence on structure. Where the evidence seems to be strongest for the idea that dopamine is involved in underpinning extroversion is the neurochemical studies. So showing that drugs that impact on the dopamine system influence behavior and experience differently for extroverts and introverts. So the response to a dopaminergic drug is very much dependent on how extroverted you are. So, I mean, that seems to be where the evidence base is really strongest, this psychopharmacological research. And it's suggesting that the systems that respond to these dopaminergic drugs are quite different, and it seems quite difficult to imagine how that would not ultimately be at least partly influenced by genetics.
Okay, that's fair. That's fair. So it is possible. So, obviously experiences impact the structure of the brain as well.
Yeah.
But I just keep thinking about, a major difference, not just being structure, but what triggers dopamine release. Appetitive rewards seem to trigger dopamine release in extroverts more than it does in introverts. And I find that really interesting, because I don't think we have a really good biological understanding of what is about that nervous system that is more sensitive, that makes this the because we have the same quantities of dopamine in extroverts and introverts. What differs is what activates the release.
So, I think it's I mean, it's not so much that there are different things that activate the release, but there seems to be a lower threshold, I suppose.
Good point.
Yeah, so that the system, as a reward processing system, it's working very similarly for extroverts and introverts, but it's just got a slightly more kind of hair trigger for extroverts.
Or very much more hair trigger, depending on where you
bigger,
are.
Events that are of motivational significance, any kind of reward events, just really kind of capture the attention of this system, if you like. A rewarding event for an extrovert is being processed by the brain as if this is really important. You've really got to focus on this.
Right.
Yeah. But in terms of why that might be, the ultimate reason for that is really quite a difficult one to answer. I mean, were you thinking along the lines of, you asked this question about early experiences. Do you wonder if there could be early experiences that shape, that kind of tune the sensitivity of that neurochemical system?
Absolutely.
There might be these experiences earlier in life that really switch on one child's brain to be really strongly impacted upon by these incentives and reward events.
Yes, I suspect that that it has a lot to do with these so-called sensitivity genes that have been discovered in recent years. Mm-hmm. That are not that these genes code for sensitivity to the environment for better and worse, and so early in life, some of these genes may, like really traumatic life experiences may cause those genes to be hypersensitive and result in neuroticism as a trait or introversion. The same genes in a very welcoming, encouraging environment would be related to openness to experience and curiosity. And you do see some research there on, depending on, your kind of background experience, you either have intense curiosity or intense fear of the environment.
Right. Yeah. Of novelty?
Yeah, of novelty. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
But there's so much that needs to be fleshed out, you know?
Yeah. That's the interesting thing. With this whole area of the neurobiology of extroversion, I think, and that on the one hand, it's often kind of held up as the sort of success story in personality neuroscience, that that's where we know most about the role of dopamine in extroversion. But then on the other hand, we know so little even about that.
Right.
Its success story is also an illustration of how still in its infancy the whole area of these questions, nature and nurture, how genes might influence personality, how early experiences might influence personality and shape brain structure and neurochemical responses. I mean, there's just sort of questions everywhere still, with not so many firm answers at the moment. I mean, even the whole theory, the so-called dopamine hypothesis of extrovert, the actual finer details of that hypothesis are very vague. It's you could be quite critical and say, okay, so basically, all years later, all we're saying is dopamine has something to do, something about dopamine differs between extroverts and introverts. It's still not that precise.
No, it really isn't. So we don't know anything. What do you think's the future? I'll end with this question. This interview has gone really long because I find this stuff so fascinating. But where do you see the future? What tech methodologies? How can we move the field forward? I'll answer it my way. I'll answer what I think, and then I'd love to hear what you think. I think there needs to be a lot more research on the effects of personality, times, environment, interactions. I think you'll find that introverts will report higher well-being when you stop with the living in an extroverted ideal world. You give them like, you know, like ways to express themselves, and that's more conducive to how they on their own terms. You may find that well-being increases.
Right.
So that's a possibility. It's just looking at those interactions. But yeah, so what do you think?
Yeah, I mean,
I do agree.
I mean, I think there's really, and there does seem to be a sort of an increase in trying to focus more on interactions between personality and situations, and I think that will be a real growth area. I don't know if I could put my finger on just one thing, but I mean, I think there are a cluster of things. I mean, maybe the slightly less interesting one to talk about is the methodological advances. I mean, I think people at the moment with all of these, you know, non-replication crises and underpowered, you know, studies that just aren't based on enough, on a sufficiently large sample size. I think that's all going to change. I mean, our standards for what is a good study are just going to change, and that will be a good thing. I mean, I think the next 10 years relative to the last 10 years is maybe going to bring a lot more certainty, because the rigor with which we do our research is just going to be held to a much higher standard. And I think, one of the really sort of exciting areas to come will be in the area that we've already gone across, that we've already sort of skipped across, that we sort of, you know, reached the point where we know that, that nature and nurture is involved in personality. It's a product of genes in the environment, and starting to pin down some of those specific causes. So, you know, we haven't been able to pin down too many specific genes yet, but maybe that's going to improve. And it would be really interesting to see people starting to pin down, these unique experiences people have. What kinds of unique experiences shape particular traits? There would be some examples that I would think of what I would like to see.
Wow. Well, I would love to see the same stuff. Maybe we can collaborate someday.
yeah, that would be great.
That'd be so cool, man. Well, thank you so much for this chat. It was elucidating. I hope it was elucidating to my listeners as well.
Really fun. Yeah, thanks. Thanks very much for inviting me, and really interesting conversation.
Thanks for listening to the Psychology Podcast with Dr. Scott Barry Kaufman. I hope you found this episode just as informative and thought-provoking as I did. If you'd like to read the show notes for this episode or hear past episodes, you can go to thepsychologypodcast.com.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. It's a simple truth. No matter who you are, mental health challenges can affect you, and how you manage them can make all the difference. That's why everyone should have access to mental health support that meets them where they are and helps them get through. BetterHelp provides online therapy on your schedule. It's flexible, simple to use, and more affordable than in-person therapy. Connect with a licensed therapist selected just for you. Learn more at BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com.
This is Amy Brown from Four Things with Amy Brown. Today, healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations with Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways that healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.
Are you feeling overwhelmed by anxiety, struggling to find restful sleep, or plagued by a restless inability to focus? It's time to break free from the chains of mental health challenges and discover a path to healthy living. Welcome to Amen University, founded by renowned psychiatrist and brain health expert, Dr. Daniel Amen. Dr. Amen, alongside a team of esteemed doctors and experts in their fields, understands the struggles you're facing and are here to offer solutions. From debilitating anxiety to sleepless nights filled with worry, our courses are meticulously crafted to target these specific challenges head on. Join us on a journey of transformation led by Dr. Amen and a roster of top-tier professionals. Say goodbye to the constant battle with your mind and embrace a future filled with hope and possibility. Visit our website today to explore our courses and start your journey towards a brighter tomorrow. Use code BRAIN10 and get 10% off. That's code BRAIN10 and get 10% off your first purchase. Amen University, because your mental health matters.